This audio download is Rethinking Revolution 5, The Republican Tradition, A Place to Build From. You'll find more audio downloads, including more Rethinking Revolution recordings, at the WSM website at www.wsm.ie.
So welcome to, I think this is the fifth of the Rethinking Revolution series. We had four, we did in the kind of spring, early summer, and then we got a bit disorganised over the summer as happens, and there was a rather long gap before we got back to this one. But the intention will be to try and keep them going monthly, on a monthly basis again. So I'm doing tonight's introduction. I've talked about 20 minutes or so, and then we'll have 40 minutes or however long people want for discussion. The title tonight was Republicanism, the Right Starting Point. And so part of our motivation here is that the WSM gets a fair bit of stick from some anarchists in Ireland and leftist communists internationally for our willingness to work on a day-to-day basis with organisations of the Republican left. Anarchism traditionally is quite a strong anti-nationalist current to it, but also it has a strong anti-imperialist current, and it's one of those unresolved differences or arguments that anarchists tend to have. Part of our motivation here is to give people a chance to air some of these opinions in the real world, and part of it is to give a political critique of socialist or left republicanism, which we wouldn't do in general think was appropriate for stuff where we're actually working alongside people like, say, Shell, Sea, or 4% Network. There's a crude version of this debate between republican and anarchism which goes something like this. Kind of from the Republican point of view, anarchism has no attraction to anyone in Ireland apart from a few students. Where the working class take up radical politics, it is Republican politics they've historically taken up. That's pretty much always been the case. The left is only relevant when it comes to a Republican left that combines the fight for socialism with that for national liberation. And then from the anarchist side, Republicanism is just another form of nationalist ideology that whatever left rhetoric it might use to get support at the end of the day just delivers capitalism as usual, but on those green, white and gold rather than red, white and blue. Should be green, white and orange, of course. And whatever about a section of the Catholic working class being attracted to republicanism, the Protestant working class in the north have no interest and are hostile to it. So that sort of nationalism can only serve to divide the working class. That's kind of a polite version of the crude debate, and normally a bit more swearing and stuff and ad hominems in there. But it's a useful starting point because both positions are more or less true to an extent, even though in both cases things are actually a little bit more complex. On the global level in the developed world, you could say that republicanism as an ideology no longer has a radical component, as the fight against monarchy has been to a large extent won everywhere. Generally, in the West, at least, we live in parliamentary democracies. For sure, our comrades in Britain still have a little way to go, but otherwise it's a lesson that's generally true. The American, French and Haitian revolutions of 200 years ago began the process of transforming the way society was organised, bringing an end to a couple of thousand years when absolute monarchy tended to be the rule, accompanied by slavery or near slave conditions for the rest of the population. For a long period of time, that was seen as the natural order, and republicanism was this kind of crazy idea how the hell would be complete chaos. But the contradictions within republicanism were also visible from that far back, whether in the form of the American revolutionaries like Thomas Jefferson, who also happened to be slaveholders, or the French revolutions who wanted to hold on to Haiti as a colony, or indeed the Haitian revolutionaries and self-liberated slaves who intended to maintain compulsory paid labour on the old plantations. The winning of freedom in terms of political democracy did not bring an end to economic inequality, even if in general there was normally at least a section of those Republican movements that advocated that transformation as well. And that's part of the problems you get with the debate is people tend to mean a single thing and fail to recognise that actually there's always been a range of positions within any of those historical movements and within the movements today. In Ireland in the 1790s, we had a mass Republican movement influenced by the American and then the French revolutions. And that movement included those who favoured a radical levelling agenda, as well as the democratic agenda of mainstream Republicans. So Edward Fitzgerald, who was the kind of military planner of the Rising, was one such proponent. But it also contained those like Wolfe Tone, who saw an independent Ireland as potentially opening up its own colonies in the Caribbean. In the north, Henry Joy McCracken had to remove the existing United Irish leadership, which was paralysed by fear of the mob seizing property, before the Rising there could get underway, some weeks after it had begun in the south. After its defeat and before his execution, he warned future Republicans to beware that the rich always betray the poor. That's one of those slogans you'll often see used by left Republicans. It's not that unusual to see them murals, say. That particular lesson, though, was repeated over the next 200 years in this country. In 1848, the Young Ireland Rebellion, in the middle of the famine, failed to catch light, at least in part because William Smith O'Brien, who was the wealthy landlord that led the Rising, forbade the seizing of food from the big houses, or even the felling of trees to block roads without the permission of the owner of the estate. I actually was just recently reading a history of that, and it's kind of extraordinary, the fact that he imagined you could raise an army and maintain it without finding provisions for it in 1848. As before, there was also a radical levelling minority, and let's start to call them the Republicans at this point, who opposed that policy, but the unity of the movement came first. And this is one of the issues. I mean, it's not that these debates have not always been there, but they've tended to go to a certain point, and then the question becomes one of preserving national unity in the face of the external aggressor. In the 1860s, the Left of the Fenians played a significant, if not yet fully researched, role in the creation of the Land League and the Land War that followed. But the Fenians, as an organisation, decided not to pursue that strategy, and other Fenian leaders denounced it as divisive and as disastrous. Now, that sort of process was mirrored in Republican movements elsewhere in the world. Left Republicans would build real popular struggles, but then be confronted with the need to preserve national unity in the face of the wealthy Republicans, whose funds were often needed for arms backing, who feared a loss of their privilege if the mob was armed. And this is where we find the roots of the early anarchist movement, coming out of the concrete experience of left Republicans like Bakunin in Poland or the Italians in Italy. In Bakunin's case, he travelled to Poland to take part in the insurrection there in 1863, but became disillusioned when he realised that the Polish Republican landlord class were far more concerned about protecting the estates from Polish peasants than they were with winning Polish liberation from the Russians. In the Italian case, many of those people had fought alongside Mussolini to liberate Italy and to unify it, only to discover that the economic misery of the mass of the people continued as before, but under a single democratic state, as opposed to the old patchwork of kingdoms and papal holdings. And if you look at the first kind of documents written by anarchists, as anarchists, organisational documents in the 1860s, they have a very strong kind of left republican element that's quite recognisable as you're sort of going through them, and reflects where those people were coming, but the limitations they'd run up and the way they were trying to go through it. In Ireland, however, no anarchist movement emerged in this period. Well, that's almost true, it's not quite. Fintan Lane recently revealed there was, in fact, a small anarchist group in Dublin in the 1860s in his book on the history of the early Irish left. It's well worth reading. But that group didn't last long, but it didn't seem to go into the 1870s. The struggles during the Anglo-Irish War of the late 1910s did see a spontaneous syndicalist upsurge, 5 general strikes, 17 local general strikes, and in the region of 80 workplace occupations called Soviets, or even the Limerick Soviet, a week long, sort of take over the whole city. Now, that's too complex and detailed to cover here. I've written a fair bit about it elsewhere. But it did demonstrate that radical ideas that had some parallels with anarchism could and did take hold, even in the conditions of Ireland at that time. It wasn't that it was... It was something that kind of Irish workers or Irish small farmers were incapable of understanding. In fact, it came up spontaneously, really, without it even being pushed by anybody. But otherwise, it's pretty much the late 1960s before there's any sort of organised anarchist presence in the islands. There are a few anarchist individuals in the years between, and they tended to some sort of association with the Republican movement. Captain Jack White, who was the founder of the Irish Citizen Army, and went on to become an anarchist in the 1930s, being perhaps the best known of these. And in the late 1960s and the early 1970s, the movement that did emerge came from returned emigrants on the one hand, often coming back from London, where they'd experienced the anarchist movement there, and on the other hand, disaffected left Republicans. So in terms of historical developments, anarchism and republicanism have had a lot in common. And in fact, I'm sort of arguing that anarchism can be understood as an offshoot of republicanism in the Europe of the 1860s. An offshoot that emerged in first time in Europe in the 1860s, but actually has emerged on other occasions in other countries. I mean, you can look at the movements in China, and the anarchist movement to a certain extent predates the Republican movement there, but also to a certain extent emerges out of it after the apparent success in 1913. And in Ireland, that's essentially in part where it came from in the 1970s, where some of those leaving the official Republican movement became anarchists, and then other anarchists were joining both provisional and official Republican movements. Now, this is a rather difficult set of historical facts for those who want to maintain that polar opposite analysis I sketched out at the start. But it also does not do away with some of the major differences between the two. It's not an argument, in other words, that there's no difference between anarchism and republicanism, other the differences are only minor, they're actually quite major. The difference, though, and because I'm talking about left republicanism and socialist republicanism for the most part, is not one about being pro or anti-capitalist, at least not as it's commonly understood by most people. Socialist republicanism differs from mainstream republicanism because its adherents also see themselves as anti-capitalist. Now, we can discuss just what that means in reality, but their attitude is certainly not that all that is needed is to change the colour of the flags. Indeed, James Connolly ridiculed those nationalists who thought freedom could come about simply by swapping the crown for the car. And again, that's one of their popular quotations.
Right.
The problem's a different one. The problem really is that we don't see socialist republicanism as capable of building the sort of united working class movement that can transform this island and then go with other similar movements internationally. And this brings us back to one of the arguments I started with. The idea that while republicanism appears to have a natural constituency among a section of the working class, particularly in the north, it has little to offer because of the historical divisions that exist within the working class, particularly in the north. That is, for the million or so Protestants in the north, for some considerable period of time, have identified as being against Irish separatism, and that's an identity that's actually become much more strong in recent years. And the very marriage of nationalism and socialism that makes republicanism attractive to some layers of Catholic workers makes it repellent to layers of Protestant workers. Now, the standard answer to this is that, Wolf Tone and Robert Emmet, William Smith O'Brien, Bulmer Hobson, and even Ronnie Bunting of the official IRA and then the INLA were all Protestants. Wasn't Irish republicanism developed and led for the first 50 years by Protestants, and didn't they play a significant role in the leadership afterwards? Bunting, as I said, was chief of staff for the INLA. In June of 1795, wasn't it several Irish Protestants gathered on the top of Cape Hill overlooking Belfast that swore, quote, never to desist in our efforts until we had subverted the authority of England over our country and asserted our independence, and thus gave birth to republicanism in Ireland, unless for the sake of a row we want to count the visit of Cromwell and the New Model Army somewhat previously. And from this sort of perspective, loyalism is often seen as some sort of bad dream that has somehow seized the Protestant mind, and which can be blown away with the correct understanding of the historical facts. You know, the sort of, did you know King Billy was blessed by the Pope after the Battle of the Boyne School? Which in its most sophisticated form falls into sort of the Marxist idea of false consciousness, you know, that these people don't really understand where their interests lie. There are two problems with this approach. The first is that it's an argument that republicanism actually lost in the 1790s, and which has got a progressively weaker argument ever since that date. Protestant support for Irish separatism in the 1790s was a brief break from the sectarian history that went before and the sectarian history that came afterwards, rather than a reality that can be returned to if only people wake up or the argument is presented in the correct way. You know, for the vast period of history, that has been the reality has been that sectarian division and a reaction against republican ideas. And secondly, Irish separatism reacted to the growth of class tensions within the population in Ireland by creating an imagined community of nationalists that could overcome those tensions in order to build the strength needed to defeat imperialism. This wasn't a left project, even if some left Republicans bought into it. Rather, the nation that was imagined was a sort of Gaelic peasant and Catholic one. The irony is that many of those who led this project were also Protestants, Bulmer Hobson being one. But any reasonable read has to recognise that the Gaelic revival created a set of additional cultural barriers to reaching out to the bulk of northern Protestants. One indication being that it resulted in loyalism dropping the usage of the Irish language, which actually wasn't that uncommon up to that point, even at kind of Orange Order conferences. And it's also pretty impossible to imagine an Orange Lodge of today declaring that, as Orange men, as freeholders, as Irish men, we consider the extinction of our separate legislature as the extinction of the Irish nation. That's Lodge 500 in 1800, back during the debates about the Act of Union. Indeed, hostility to the cultural agenda of Irish separatism has reached such a level that a very large segment of northern Protestants are now trying to define themselves as something other than Irish, regardless of the geographical space where they are born, live and die. And if you think about it, that's a pretty extreme divide that's being expressed in that. This cultural divide has, of course, been reinforced and extended by the military struggles of the last 100 years. In the 1790s, the problem in uniting Catholic Protestants in the centre under the title of Irish Republican was already in existence as a substantial mythology of massacre and counter-massacre that was part of everyday discussion and used politically to cement the divisions of the poorer classes. The rebellion in Wexford ended up fatally adding to that narrative, the theme of Republican betrayal of non-sectarian rhetoric, which is often used today whenever a section of northern Protestants takes an interest in pure republicanism, as what happened in the 1930s with their Republican clubs. It doesn't really matter that actually the story of 1798 is much more complex than that. Myths tend not to go in very much for complexity. You know, you just get these kind of simple truths. The war of the last four decades has served to cement this mythology in the current generation, meaning it's pretty much impossible for anyone to operate as a Republican in working-class Protestant areas of the North. And if you can't even carry out political activity, how can you hope to overcome such a deeply entrenched mythology? In that context, Irish separatism, even of the left Republican variety, has almost no realistic hope of uniting the working class in the islands. And without that unity, there can be no fundamental change in the economic and political systems that run our lives. Now, what I've said probably seems a little unfair and one-sided, and it is. I've not really touched on the role of British imperialism in shaping this dynamic, or of the reactionary nature of loyalism in general. And that's basically because I'm giving this talk in a radical space in Dublin, and our intention in these Rethinking Revolution seminars is to be provoking and avoid reassuring those who attend with old truths and familiar arguments. I'm not really expecting that we're going to get all that many loyalists or fans of British imperialism in the audience tonight, so I've decided not to actually try and qualify any of this. I think the problem we face, both in terms of anarchists and left Republicans alike, is how to help nurture the Irish Revolution in the context of the global revolution. And in many ways, the problem for us in Ireland can be summarised under that old cliché or saying, if I wanted to go there, I wouldn't start from here. Our native revolutionary tradition does indeed contain history that can be drawn from, but as a package, it's not really fit for purpose. The problem, though, is that it is enough of an attraction to a section of the working class that almost any left project based around republicanism will almost instantly be able to generate a level of interest that goes beyond what the existing revolutionary left and anarchist movements can achieve. Again and again, this means socialist republicanism is seen as the best strategy on offer. It looks like some sort of shortcut. The question for anarchists is what we do with this. How do we deal with the reality that we are in rather than where we might wish we were? We might wish we lived in Barcelona, for instance. We might wish to be in one of the European countries where anarchism is one of the defaults, or close to defaults, things that people understand by revolutionary politics. I mean, revolutionary politics in Ireland, to most people, means republicanism of one sort or another. And therefore, where anarchism would be a first port of call for people discovering radicalism in their teens, typically. Not only is this not the case here, but those attracted to anarchism are almost certainly going to be those who have already looked at and rejected republicanism in a determined but not necessarily terribly deep way. And the consequence of this is that they often end up with a sort of shallow and sectarian view of Irish republicanism, one that sees only the reactionary and militarist angles I've been talking about here. Or less common, but also not unknown, are people from Republican backgrounds who become anarchists, but still carry a good deal of the basic assumptions of republicanism. Now, that's a sort of recipe for a set of disastrous misunderstandings and pointless internal debates within the movement. And indeed, this week I was reading a perfect example online in relation to the Just Books fundraising in Belfast and the fact that one of the people playing for it was a supporter of the Republican Unity Network, and you know, people going backwards and forwards on that in a really unproductive way. I think the challenge for anarchists in Ireland is to recognise the common point of politics and method we have with socialist republicanism, and to be therefore able to engage in common work on the ground without losing sight of the political differences that exist between us. The greater challenge, I think, for both socialist republicans and anarchists is to come up with a political organising method and a set of goals that can have that sort of mass influence, that can carry people through it, and that break through the particular barriers we face here. So that's what I have as a way of an introduction. If people want to put their hands up, and we just take people in the order their hands appear, it's probably the easiest way to do it.
That was really informative. I was just wondering if people think that the attraction to republicanism in like working class areas or whatever still exists, or if it's weaker, I don't know.
Maybe. If I'm truthfully honest, I think. I live in Rockhampton, and I helped Christy work as a Dublin City Councillor, and for many years, he was a Sinn Féin councillor, and previous to that he was a Dublin IRA man. People around here, I'm more worried about being able to pay their rent, whether they can look forward to that milk to their cornflakes. To be quite honest with you, yes, I'm passionate about Irish unity and a socialist republic, but realistically, when people come up to Christie on the ground, they don't talk about the north of Ireland, they talk about getting housing. I've been able to survive from one day to the next. But I wish it was more relevant, so yeah.
It may be a generational thing. I know in my in-laws' family, the older, you know, in their 70s, 80s, you know, still pretty strong.
Yeah, I mean, what I would say on that is that the mass, the population of the South have never, well, outside of brief periods like the Anglo-Irish War and the kind of the workplace stuff, they have never been actively involved in politics. And what I'm really talking about, I think, is the minority who do get involved and what those influences are. And for a long period of time, that has always tended to be some form of republicanism. Whether or not that's changing, I think, is actually an interesting question, because there's certainly, at least to an extent, part of the generation for that was the fact that the Republican movements, you know, had an armed struggle, and that when that in the period when that was somewhat popular, that was, you know, was an attraction, because, you know, a lot of people, that's radicalism, guy with a gun, woman with a gun, that's, you know, that tends to be what people put in posters and stuff, you know, to their image of what radicalism is. And it also fits very tightly into the Irish revolutionary tradition, which is, you know, tended to be about staging armed rebellions. But the question as to whether that influence is still as strong today, I don't know, that's an interesting question. I think it's probably, to a large extent, everybody's has become much more depoliticised. Mm. You know, and that probably has affected absolutely everyone.
Just on that, I think that where kind of my sense of republicanism is that it's increasingly becoming an identity for people rather than a political philosophy. I mean, it's something people adhere to because that's who they are, and that's, you know, it's not a dynamic kind of moving, arguing political philosophy anymore. That's my sense of it.
Got a question. What attitude do you think should be taken to the question of the armed struggle? Because I think that the left Republicans still either are engaged in or yearn for the armed struggle, for planting bombs and so on. Insofar as you get a hostile reaction from most people, a lot of it is to that. I mean, what do you think about that? Or what do people think about that? Do you think that's a way to go at the moment or not? Or was a way to go but isn't now, or would be in the future, or what?
This is probably going to be a weird analogy. I don't think armed struggle should define Republican movement or Republican socialism, but it should always be there as an option if need be. To take on British, but it shouldn't define republicanism for generation to generation for generation. It should come a point where we can get involved in actions. Well, I mean, actions like today, or the action that Ari took at an Anglo-Irish bank, but it doesn't have to involve anybody being murdered, but you can make a valid argument, and direct action without anybody getting serious report. Don't
yeah, it's kind of introducing another point, but.
I'd have no problem at all saying the current period I'd see armed struggle as counterproductive and reactionary. The kind of the logic of what I'm saying anyway is that really for most of the last 100 years that would be close to being true. It's been pushing us in the wrong, you know, if our aim is class unity, it's always been pushing us in the wrong direction. Now, within that, though, there are particular stages when really it's inevitable. I think was Robert Kennedy said that thing about, you know, those who make peaceful revolution impossible make armed revolution inevitable or something. So, you know, somebody like Kennedy can kind of stop that. I think that it's definitely true here in Ireland. So I think that, you know, Bloody Sunday, for instance, would be the kind of one of the key turning points where when you're in the situation where, you know, demonstration is greeted by, you know, shooting dead 13 people, the fact that then a lot of people go, OK, I want a gun so I can shoot back, would seem to be a bit of a no-brainer. Now, it's more complex than that because, on the other hand, you do have, within the kind of national standard Republican movement at the time, you have people who want it to be pushed in that direction as well. So there's a space there to take advantage of it. But, you know, the periods of armed struggle where republicanism in Ireland is most interesting are the periods where that is seen in the context of a mass struggle, rather than the question of, you know, training 200, 300, 400, 1,000, 2,000 people. You know, so stuff like 98 is interesting because it was an attempt to basically arm the entire population. You know, and you know, that's one particular thing. But the I think one of the problems you have as a socialist Republican today is that armed struggle is now so strongly associated with Republicanism that if you don't have an armed wing, you'll get a load of people who won't take you seriously because of it. You know, be like, you're not doing stuff properly or whatever. And that's one of the actual barriers. But I think, yeah, in the current context, it's just, yeah, it doesn't make sense. And really, in the context of the last 40 years, if it hadn't developed into the situation where it went into an armed struggle, we'd probably be in a much better place than we are. But the reasons why that happens are not purely or even mostly down to the Republican movement at that time. It's also very much down to what the British state did and what loyalism did.
Sorry, I mean, are you going to make a different point? Can I?
Yeah, we'll try, yeah.
You don't mind, sorry.
No.
Just a couple of things you said there, like Bloody Sunday. I think Bloody Sunday is I mean, I'm kind of coming to the conclusion that Bloody Sunday was a victory for the British state, which, you know, and they just declared the victory in Derry a few months ago, you know, by embracing Derry as the UK city of culture. And by giving this mealy-mouthed apology that people had to accept. But it was a victory because it pushed resistance. It was the death knell for people power. It pushed resistance out of a terrain that the state couldn't cope with into a terrain that it's an expert at, which is military terrain. The British state is an imperial state with all the resources of a state at its disposal. It loves an open war. And I think that was a deliberate tactic by the British state, and for that reason, incidentally, I think that, like, I don't advocate that kind of armed struggle for anarchists either. It's not just because of the politics of republicanism. I just think that as soon as you do that, the state has won. I think it was Umberto Eco said, "You can't attack the state at its heart because the state doesn't have a heart. The state loves it when you take it onto that terrain."
I ask the question because I'm a Marxist, and I'm in favour of mass and necessary violent revolution, but I don't see how you can defeat a modern capitalist state by planting a few bombs or shooting a few people, whoever they are. I don't see how it's supposed to work, even apart from all the negative effects it has. At its best, how's it supposed, you know, you think you can get a big enough army of snipers to defeat the state? You can't. I think it's
struggle as well. I think the other thing is that people have now, in the popular minds, struggle and armed struggle have been conflated.
Which is really one dodgy. Thing.
You talk to anybody about struggle, yeah, and they think you mean armed struggle. Yeah. And that puts a lot of people off and gives your enemies plenty of ammunition.
Yeah, can I just respond to that? It was very interesting. I happened to be there. I was outside in Ballyfermot when Louise Minahan threw red paint over Harney. And then I heard on the Joe Duffy programme. I'm from England, I only just came here, but I was astonished, to be honest, not by the fact that somebody threw paint over Mary Harney, but by the reaction. You would think she was a murderer. I mean, immediately it was, you're a sniper. I mean, you know, it was very strange to see it coming from. I've only been in the country a couple of months. I've been a socialist activist in England, but it was very strange because if somebody threw paint over a Tory minister in England at the moment, they wouldn't get half as much stick.
To be a hero.
Well, probably they would, but she was getting all this stick, and I think it's because of what you know. Immediately, you throw red paint over. You know, you see what the guards did today. They won't get any stick. Mm-hmm. These people get horrified at a bit of red paint. I agree with what you're saying.
I really agree with what you were saying there. I've been reading about this recently, and I think it's not a coincidence that in a good few European countries around 1968 or shortly after, the state deliberately tried to militarise politics. And if I'm not wrong, I think in Northern Ireland, even the first bomb was planted by the UVF as a hoax, a fake thing on the day that some legislation to do with like criminalising the movement was going through. And the first RUC person killed in the Notch was killed by the UVF. And in Italy, also fascist groups planted bombs and pretended it was the left. Like, so they always tried to hype up that behind every political movement there's a military plot. And it's for exactly that reason, because it takes out people power. Because once you have a military situation, everything is just reduced to, like what you were saying, unity, because it's a military struggle, so you're either with us or against us, and there can be no thinking about politics anymore effectively.
Yeah.
But the other thing, and this is what I was going to say originally, that I think the thing that republicanism has, like Irigy now, where I see them having political potential, even though I'm not a Republican, I'm where I'd be worried about them having political potential, is that they're not kind of democratic, you know, exactly. They don't really think about building a mass movement in the way I do. If they think they have the right to do something, they just do it.
Yeah.
And they don't care. So they're much more rebellious. And that's, you know, it's weird because in a way, like, Republicans fight to have a state. You know, that's how they see emancipation happening, by getting a state or whatever. But when they act, they don't really, they're not really concerned about legality. Which is really powerful, because it's that, you know, it has an element of radicality. Yeah. And I think it's problematic that Republicans have kind of monopolized that. Like in Dublin, since Irigy have come on the scene, they've been doing most of, as far as I can see, the actions that have a civil disobedience component. And they know they're going to get slaughtered in the media, but they just don't care. Like they just go for it. I don't know if that's insane or if it's good, but...
Well, I'm not officially a member of Irigy, but I've been a tied in. Yeah, they don't. Well, like I think ideally most I don't know if people in the workers' solidarity movement would feel the same way about like whether trying to build up a mass movement because of the state of the country at the moment, the political system is just behind developers and the banking system. It's about direct action. It's about this civil disobedience. It's about it's about underscoring a point about what's going on. But look at like Louise did. She underscored a point. Like a billion. It's like I think 3 billion was Or that figure was taken away from health last year, and another billion is going to be taken off this year. And if anybody listened to Adrian Kennedy's show, there was a lady on there near the end there, and she was, I don't know whether she lost her child, but there was a lack of facilities. And the action of Louise done, it's not something that I would do personally, but at the same time, what Louise done, she underscored a point. And when Ergie occupied Anglo-Irish Bank, they're underscoring the point that people should be getting out on the streets, not necessarily to join Ergie, but to get out. People are part of community groups, sporting groups, where people are going to be banging on the door or the TD saying, we need money to keep ourselves going, to pay off electricity, food, get facilities. Not going to happen because most of the money is going to be tied up with NAMA, basically the next generation or a couple of generations are going to be trying to sort out the mess. But at the same time, everything else is on hold. And some of the 12 tests that I mentioned are trying to underscore a point. Maybe get people saying, well, okay, it is Ergy, they are Republican Socialists, but what they're doing, well, we should be doing it. Because what Ergy are trying to say to the people, especially people drinking in pubs, because I go home and all I hear is people complaining about the government this, the government that, but they won't get off their backsides. Now, Ergy are providing a platform, and they shouldn't really be the only ones doing. There should be more other different groups doing it. But people basically should be saying to people that this country, as well as in the north of Ireland, to get off your arse and do something about it. Because there's more. At the end of the day, okay, the police and army have quite heavy numbers and have quite organised structures. But at the end of the day, there's more of us as an potentially angry people than there is of them, and they have all the padding and the guns and the spring battens and what have you. But at the end of the day, as a mass movement, never mind whether it's done by or protest action or it's done by our people. That's my general point.
Yeah, I think nothing specifically around the question of Ergy, because obviously our relationship with them is one of the reasons why this meeting has some relevance. Like we've had an informal working relationship between some of our members and some of those around Shelter City for a long time now, which is really based upon a sort of common view of tactics, what needed to be fought for in terms of, you know, particularly making the question of the national resources issue centrally, and also to an extent at least the sort of democratic structure of the campaign and what should be there. So I'm not sure about the point about democracy you were making. So far we've tended to head towards a common perspective on that. I agree there is a bit of a general question that republicanism in Ireland does, particularly the more reactionary end, does tend to have this view of itself as not actually needing any sort of mandate at all. Mm. All that matters is the judgment of history type stuff. Mm. And you got the particularly ludicrous situation, I think it was with RSF about a decade ago, when the last member of the First Dáil died who'd taken the anti-treaty side. Mm. They made a big deal out of the fact he'd said they were, you know, the next guys, and this more or less made them the legitimate government, you know, which is kind of, it's almost like a bit of magic, essentially, you know, that's happened, passing this magical baton. So that trend definitely exists. I don't think they have a particularly strong lead. And then more recently, that relationship obviously became formalised around the anti-capitalist bloc and then 1% network, which, you know, involves us and other groups actually working together on it. And again, I think really the question there is, like, there's a common sort of perception of tactics, at least in relation to the kind of direct action stunts, really more stunts more often than anything else, and targeting this idea that 1% own 34% of the wealth as being something that's kind of an essential thing to get into people's heads, so they start having this argument about whether to cut, you know, single mothers or public sector workers, which is what I was hearing on Joe Duffy today. I don't know why I listen to that show, but I always think he's stuck on it. You know, the need to shift that. Now, I think one of the areas where there probably is a difference is we're more inclined to see the thing that unless we can actually get the unions to move into struggle on a sort of mass basis, that it's going to be very hard to actually win this. You know, I mean, I thought what happened today was, you know, great in terms of the, you know, students going up in the ante a bit, and at least you had that creation of an impression of some resistance going on for first time in a long time. But, you know, I'm not particularly of the opinion that the government will reverse its policy because of a really big riot at some point in the future. You know, I can't really see any transformation happening without at the very least a protracted general strike. Saying that, I know we're a hell of a long way from it. And I think probably that would be closer to our own perspective on it. But in a lot of the reality, I think, of the conditions we actually find ourselves working in, the reason why that relationship has discovered on that day-to-day stuff, we've had quite a similar perspective.
I'll just say, I think maybe the two strands of the conversation there are kind of similar, which is the relationship of the organised political group to the larger body of people who aren't organised or are organised but are not active and are not active politically. And it's definitely a question that anarchists have had to deal with as well. I mean, but I guess our policy has always been that things aren't going to happen unless the unless a mass movement happens, and that the role of the anarchists is always to build a mass movement. Of course, there are differences within anarchism about how you do that. But I think that's something that's to be borne in mind. And anarchists have had experience in various situations, including reasonably recently, of how you do that in a context of armed struggle, with the an anarchist federation in Uruguay who had an armed wing, but also had a mass movement. And I think that was quite a big political issue for them, was how do you make sure that the one which was necessary to protect them from being absolutely repressed horrifically would prevent the struggle, the mass struggle of other people becoming disempowered. And they had a couple of ways of doing it, and it seems to have been reasonably effective as these things go, and in the Latin American context. But I think there are examples we can look at in that relationship.
Unless that question resolved.
Make sure you write that down.
Yeah.
Can I raise another one then?
Yeah.
Okay. On the national question, I speak as a Marxist, and the position that I've always taken, the traditional sort of Marxist position on the national question, was that you defended the rights of oppressed nations to self-determination. You were against imperialism, so in that sense you supported Irish unity kind of unconditionally, was the phrase. But you thought you could do this without being a nationalist. You do this on an international basis. That's the idea. What strikes me as different in the Irish situation is there's still a national question. The British state still controls Northern Ireland and so on. But it seems to me that whether you're in the south or even in the north now, that the national question is probably not the main issue concerning working class people, false consciousness or otherwise. I mean, it's not whether you think their consciousness is false or true, whichever way around you put it, it just isn't. I mean, I know that the Catholic working class is still discriminated against compared with the Protestant to some extent, but it's the main issue surely facing us all. Is the avalanche of cuts is going to, coming down on everybody, coming down on the Irish working class, coming down on the British working class, coming down on the French working class, and whatever. That isn't just a few, whatever you want to do about it, that's surely everybody feels that way. Whether you want to resist it or think it's inevitable or whatever, that's what's on people's minds. So does that change our relationship on the national question, or what do people think?
I'll just offer to that that I think that nationalism as an ideology, and republicanism were forged, in largely in the Enlightenment when they were emancipatory projects, and the nation state, to a certain extent, during the, especially, in the decolonization process across the world, starting in the late 19th century and going on into the middle half of, largely into the middle half of the last century, genuinely did. But I think the context now in the globalized neoliberal world is different. I think it's a nation state is meaningless against neoliberal capital. I mean, if all states subscribe to neoliberal ideology, then there's nothing to be gained by declaring national independence. And unless you do something like the Zapatistas, which is kind of go back and reinvent the language of the nation state and reclaim it. But I think that's a tactical thing.
Yeah, I think concretely in the Irish situation, the other complication you have is, the fact that the majority in the north don't want to be part of the south. And that traditionally this has tended to be argued both by Republicans and the left in historical terms, as in, partition was a
imperialist solution imposed on the country. There was no justice and no particular logic to it. They just drew a line on the map, blah, 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 which is true. But then again, it's also 90-plus years ago, so nobody who was alive when that particular unjust solution was imposed and was old enough to know about it is still alive. Unless maybe 103. There might be one person, but you know what I mean. And alongside that, you have the situation where increasingly, you know, it's Europe that becomes, I mean, well, particularly obvious here at the moment with us having to get a budget for the next 4 years, okay, by the EU, we're kind of going back to direct rule in another form almost. You know, with that impact, so even outside of the fact that for most people anyway, their day-to-day lives are probably being dictated by the cuts being imposed by either the Irish government or the British government, depending on which jurisdiction they live in, there has been a big historical change in the last 40 or 50 years, both in terms of just that passing of time since partition and the increasing, you know, role Europe has played in terms of deciding what policy will be in both halves. And it's actually a funny one because it's quite a hard thing for the left to say because it's a bit... I'm old enough to remember when, you know, struggle against apartheid was going on in South Africa. The left used to always say, oh, can't get rid of apartheid without a revolution, you know, and then it happens, and a bit of a shortage of recognition of it. And you still have some obscure Trotskyist groups who still think bits of Eastern Europe are still workers' states of one sort or another because they haven't had the formal process. And in a way, the North is a little bit like that, you know, in that if you look at, like, particularly kind of Sinn Féin policy, there's a whole lot of stuff that's not said that actually more or less acknowledges that kind of transformation I'm talking about, the change of historical reality. But you can't really say it out loud yet. It's kind of still a bit theoretical.
They've come out and said the Orange State is no more.
Yeah.
And I kind of agree with that analysis. Mm. That doesn't mean that they have to administer it.
Mm. But the left, yeah. The left and the obvious sort of bit behind, I think, actually yeah. Sort of...
That's the part to discuss more.
I think... There will be circumstances in which, even in today's neoliberal world, where the national question could come to the fore, and does, you know, I mean, I think that there are many, I mean, Palestine, for example, you know, where there is manifest extreme national oppression. So I would, you know, I would think, I would support the Palestinians' national struggle as an internationalist. I think that's really... And I think that could happen even in Ireland or in somewhere else. It just seems to me that at the moment you're arguing... If you're arguing about the oppression of, in the North and so on in the context of the working class in Ireland as a whole, that the oppression of the nationalist working class in Northern Ireland is not the main thing. I'm not defending it. I'm just thinking that the main question for everybody, including in Northern Ireland, is how you can resist the cuts. I mean, there was 15,000 people marched in Belfast last week against the cuts. There's 20,000 students marched today. We should have...
And Sinn Féin going up with that protest as well. I've seen their protest.
Well, good, but what I'm saying is that's the issue that's mobilising people. That's the issue we're facing, it seems to me.
I think the problem up in the North... as regards the cuts, is the treasuries. The treasury are paying for the whole show up there. They're paying the wages of the MLAs and the executive and the two first ministers. And they're basically saying, well, if you don't post the cuts, we can just have a meeting in the Commons tomorrow and just bring in direct rail and use our back to where you are again. And we'll impose the cuts anyway. But that's the thing. When I voted for the Green the 98, apart from the one I thought would be social and economical change in the North, I went up to Belfast and Derry in 99, and the ghettos were still there. Crime, just like in Fingless Ballymun, and even parts of my area, Drumcondra, crime still very high. You go up there today, things are still as know the old saying, some things change and some things never change. But things up there now haven't changed. The only difference is
the politicians there are getting paid by the British state, and basically they're all opposed to cuts. And if you ask them, look, will you because you're opposed to cuts, will you refuse to bring them in? That's where the wall of silence, and it's like a Berlin Wall of silence, but like Sinn Féin down here against private. I don't want to bash Sinn Féin, but they're against privatisation down here. But yeah, Conor Murphy's privatised the bus service up there, and I think one politician there, Mitch McLaughlin, is supportive of making savings against the elderly, taking money. Now that's something that they wouldn't, no Sinn Féin person would have said 5 or 10 years ago.
The Greens sitting there against the cuts. They're not in power.
Just the thing.
Well, I think the nature of the settlements, you know, through the Good Friday deal, one of the peculiarities of it means there's no opposition in the North anymore in terms of mainstream politics. So both sides are busy implementing the cuts, you know, on their respective populations. And I think it's one of the transformations that happens. You know, you went from the kind of idea of the Iron State, which was a state where Catholics were treated particularly badly, to a state where actually, you know, they've kind of evened up that bad treatment.
So it's essentially a unity government up there. Believe it or not, it's essentially a unity government. And I don't like using unity because we don't have a United Ireland, but up there it is practically a unity government. Essentially, there's nothing like the Sinn Féin and the SDP were meant to be democratic socialists, and the DUP and the UUP were meant to be the democratic right wing. But when the cuts coming in, they're going to be bringing up doing the cuts as an executive. They're going to be implementing the cuts. Like I know Sammy was saying, now we can argue to make sure the cuts aren't as deep. But rubbish. The whole lot of them are going to be announcing cuts in the next few weeks, just like the government down here. And as regards the national question, I want to keep it relevant, but like I said, I work for a councillor who has people looking to get homes and get jobs so that they can add milk to their cornflakes, and people are more concerned with surviving day to day, month to month, being able to pay their mortgages. And I'm afraid the national question, although it wanted to be relevant as part of a whole socialist republic, it's just not whether as a neoliberals all-Ireland republic or as a social republic, it's not there. It's just not there, unfortunately, at this moment in time. But we have to keep beaming away.
Just on that thing about, you know, government, the unity government or whatever, like, it's essentially the same here and everywhere else now, you know? Like, now, like, they don't have an actual national government, but all the media are calling for either a strong leader who understands the markets or whatever, or, like, a consensus, what they were talking about there a few weeks ago, consensus. And they haven't done it, but essentially they all agree. And even if you look at how cuts are implemented, like, there's a meeting on tomorrow night, actually, we have a leaflet to people at the end, but this is a community group that have been affected by cuts implemented by the South Inner City Drugs Task Force. And on that task force, there's people, representatives from Sinn Féin and the Labour Party, and that's how cuts are being implemented, through these partnership structures that basically everybody agrees. And then, like, I was in college today, and I was asking my students, what do they think about fees? And most of them said, you know, well, you know, it has to be done, doesn't it? Like, the money isn't there, etc. So that consensus now, like, between the parties, but basically between everybody, is huge. And that's why I think, going back to that thing about rebelling and not really caring what people think or if it's going to have an effect, if it's going to change things. That's why I was really happy to hear what the people did today by occupying the Department of Finance, because I think, at the moment, in a situation where it's impossible to really articulate something against the consensus, the thing that I'm attracted to is that rebellion, that kind of militancy, which recognises that, you know, most people are going to think you're off the wall. Because I feel like I'm trying to involve in a political project in college, but like I feel it myself, there's a lack of courage in myself, a lack of an ability to really, you know, stick to what I believe in, like, because I know all the students think I'm totally mental. So you feel like you're handing out leaflets, you feel like a total dick. And what I respect about Republicans, like the likes of Arky, is that like they don't really give a shit about that kind of thing. And that's why, you know, something like what happened today at the Department of Finance could be good for giving you courage to, you know, to kind of go for it or whatever.
No, no, it wasn't.
Who did it?
It was actually Socialist Workers Party, I seen making the quick left stage left in there. It was very well done.
I should come out. I'm in the SWP. What's the SWP?
Yeah.
Well, not exclusively, but to they were the group that initiated.
Because even in this case, you see that the state still have a really strong symbolic power, you know, like the idea at the end even of the students was to go, as you say, at the heart of the state and to occupy the Department of Finance, which is, I mean, like, is really crazy. And I think why is that there were no leaders engaging in a more Zapatista type of approach, which would have been to stay and occupy the university, for example, to act in a peripheral way and not to try to get into the heart of the state. And I think in this republicanism and socialism or anarchism have much to share.
I don't know anything about IRD really. So I just was wondering what your affiliation is, or if there's any with the IRA, or how you feel about the IRA. Because if I was to be devil's advocate, if I was reading about, say, the Mary Harney thing, as I was in the paper, obviously IRA will be portrayed as goofy. But the problem with, say, the Irish Times, and I'm not agreeing, I'm just kind of being devil's advocate, is that the woman who poured the paint or sprayed the paint on Mary Harney said, you know, that Mary Harney has a lot of blood on her hands. And for people who would be reading the Irish Times, who maybe would be kind of on the fence, they would look at, say, member of IRD and think, well, maybe you have blood on your hands from kind of supporting armed struggle. So it's just my point. Just,
I don't think we actually...
Just from the other side.
Well, I don't think we have any members of RE here, so...
Right, sorry.
But I can't remember, what was Louise's standard reply she kept giving to Joe Duffy on that one? But no connections, I think, with any...
Okay.
I mean, they don't have any...
I don't know.
That was being fired at them on the basis of
that's
them...
That's because the Sinn Féin have given up the arms struggle.
Yes.
That's why they...
But just in terms of what you're asking, but the actual, yeah, that old Joe Duffy stuff and the other reaction to it is quite interesting. And I think in terms of, like as I was saying earlier on, one of the kind of strengths of socialist republicanism is the fact that there is this republican tradition in the country that you can build on, and it makes it easier. But you do also run into some problems with it as well, which is, you know, the whiff of gunpowder is kind of an attractant from one point, you know, for one set of people, but for another set of people, they go, ooh, I'm not really sure. So even in that sort of case where you're talking about some paint being squirted, you know, and the blood in your hands thing is, you know, given the amount of premature deaths and deaths due to that superbug thing that's been happening with the health service, you know, under Harney's command for the last 10 years is a completely justified thing to say.
Mm-hmm.
But it's really easy for Joe Duffy to, you know, turn it into this debate about what the IRA would do.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what was the last time there was anybody shot by a provisional IRA sniper anyway? It's probably about 12 years ago or something. I mean,
yeah.
You know, just kind of the whole thing was illogical, but at the same time easy for him to do.
Because that's kind of like, it's very easy to put that right spin on it. I just, if I was coming from the opposite to everyone else, kind of here, maybe here's perspective, I would be thinking, well, that's very hypocritical to say that Harney has blood in your hands, but you're coming from a Republican kind of ideology. Just.
Yeah, but that's because the media have, like, well, they simplify every political ideology, and they basically use Republican to mean IRA and to mean and as a political slur. Like, very often when there's a media push to delegitimize a campaign, like Shell to Sea, for example, they would say, oh, it's now led by the Republican movement, it's a code word to make people afraid of a certain campaign, without any actual proof most of the time.
That's right.
And this is the thing, the Irish Times is respected, it will print lies.
I also think that it's worth saying, I don't think she handled it very well. I thought there were two really obvious points she could have made. One is that when you implement the kind of cuts that Mary Harney has implemented and will implement, you actually kill far more people. Far more working class people suffer and die under those cuts than any amount of IRA snipers. I mean, that's a point worth making, literally. And, you know, the main killer of people in the world today is poverty and economic exploitation, So I think that was the point she should have made. The other thing that struck me as really incredible about that was Joe Duffy had been on national television claiming that James Connolly were supporting James Connolly as Ireland's greatest. He led an armed insurrection, not just threw some paint over somebody.
Yeah.
I mean, she should have made that funny point.
Yeah.
I don't know who the hypocrite.
I hope a lot of people remember that it was Joe Duffy that was making the argument for James Connolly as Ireland's greatest person. And yes, I guarantee you, if I was in the Louisa show, I'd have said, oh, you were after trying to make an argument for a person that, and you were right, he was the wrong man. Personally, I would have had Ger O'Leary make the argument for him. If anybody knows Ger O'Leary, he's a Dublin communist. But anyway, Louise could have, but Louise just wanted. I didn't hear the interview, but I think Louise just wanted to stick to why she done it rather than concentrating her past. Like, and Louise has no past in the Provisional IRA. Like, she supported the Provisional IRA, but that's past tense.
There is an extent as well to which the whole Joe Duffy pushing Connolly thing, I mean, it's kind of amusing and ironic, but it's also a very familiar story in terms of the Southern State, because the whole legitimacy of the Southern State goes back to, you know, 1916 insurrection, and a couple of years ago we were having huge military parades around it and all that sort of stuff. And actually, on the day of, I think it was the 90th anniversary, we made a big thing in town. I remember one of the things that some of the anarchists did was we went out and we tried to get into Balldonald Aerodrome, which was somewhat involved in US military training at the same time, sort of try and make a point of contradiction. But I actually think it's probably one of those contradictions people are just so familiar with and have so completely internalised that it just goes, you know, everybody's used to this concept that the IRA was good up to 21, 23, depends exactly where you are politically, you know, and that at some point after that it becomes a problem, playing into that. I mean, it's definitely something that could have been said, but I wonder how much impact it actually has on people.
The Farley's campaign, the border campaign. Yeah.
You've got a statue of a Larkin in a couple of
streets.
And rightly so.
Well, yes, but the same contradiction.
Anybody else got anything? Nope. All right, well, so thanks for coming along to number 5. As I said, we're hoping to get these back on track. The next one, which will be in about a month, probably this day next month, we'll be looking at crime and criminal justice system and the way that works. And thanks for coming.
Thank you.
Oh, get a copy of our latest.
This audio download is Rethinking Revolution 5, The Republican Tradition, A Place to Build From. You'll find more audio downloads, including more Rethinking Revolution recordings, at the WSM website at www.wsm.org. www.republicanism.ie.